Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As I was recording last week's episode, there was a section where I was talking about this theme of having regrets, specifically from an interpersonal perspective and the power of apology in those situations. It kind of got me thinking about how, despite how powerful, again, from my perspective, something like apology or admitting that we were wrong can be, and how it can be a tool for connection and in some cases healing, it seems to be such a difficult thing for many of us. I think we walk around with our defenses up, not wanting to admit that we made a mistake or that we failed in some way, or maybe that we made a decision that may have hurt somebody else. And in my opinion, it's an interesting reflection to consider why the obsession with needing to be right, and in what ways does that often impact and hinder our ability to connect with or reconcile with others? To me, this sort of goes hand in hand with what I observe to be a collective intolerance for changing our mind or being seen as imperfect, which we also talked about in that episode. It's like we're expected to arrive at some solidified final version of ourselves where all of our views and beliefs and decisions are set in stone, and to be publicly seen evolving is almost a shameful thing. And so following recording this episode, I started to think about how something as simple as being able to apologize or admit when you were wrong or even that you changed your mind about something is such an underrated life skill. And I'm by no means saying that it comes easy necessarily to me either, but it's something that I've wanted to work on because I've been able to witness on both sides how much of a tool it can be for connection and being vulnerable with others. And so it got me thinking not just about the life skill of being able to apologize or admit we were wrong, but of other things that I believe to have the capacity to be very powerful, but that I think are sort of underrated or undervalued to some extent. So we're going to be talking about a few of those things that I've observed or that I'm practicing in this episode, as well as some of your submissions for what you think are underrated life skills. So let's start off with the one that kind of got me thinking about underrated life skills to begin with, which is, as I mentioned, apologizing or being able to admit when you were wrong in some way. And we talked about this in last week's episode from the perspective of having interpersonal regret. So maybe we responded in a conversation in a way that we didn't like, or we treated someone in such a way that we wish we hadn't, for example. What we discuss and what I was reflecting on in that episode is how the energy behind that feeling of regret and rumination has the capacity to be very consuming. It can lead to a lot of spiraling and maybe even feelings of self-loathing at worst. And what I was saying in the episode is I kind of feel like that energy is wasted if we're not actually doing something with it, whether that's internally reflecting on how we would have handled the situation differently, or, you know, directly addressing the situation and having a conversation and apologizing or admitting that we were wrong in some way. I think the reason that this is so difficult is because it obviously requires actually acknowledging within ourselves and then potentially to that other person that we were wrong. And understandably, that can be uncomfortable and vulnerable. And I think it feels very exposing. It's one thing to internally be like, okay, I messed up in some way and I would handle that differently. But to have someone else witness that feels scary sometimes, at least to me. Like, God forbid other people see us capable of making mistakes or being wrong. And I think we come by that fear very honestly, that fear of being seen as imperfect or having made a mistake in some way. If we look at a lot of the public response to people apologizing, changing their mind, people admitting being wrong in some way, from my perspective, it's not often that we see very welcoming responses to those things. It's sort of an intolerant environment towards, you know, things like people having said the wrong thing or having changed their mind. And it's created this atmosphere collectively where it's like once you're in the bad books, there doesn't seem to be any opportunity for resolution or redemption, or there's sort of no coming back from that. So I think witnessing this play out may feed into why we worry about being seen as imperfect or having made a mistake or admitting that we were wrong on an interpersonal basis. Because again, in many ways, this appears to be something that would threaten our social standing or our relationship with that person rather than being a mechanism for being able to grow closer with someone or form a connection. So I think it can be easier to just ignore the issue or sweep it under the rug, carry on as usual, hope they forget, or maybe even let the relationship fall off. And I think the personal defense mechanism of wanting to maintain the facade of always being right, always being a good person 100% of the time, can even lead to convincing ourselves somehow that the fault lies elsewhere, even when we know deep down that isn't true. Because to admit on any level to ourselves that we may have done something that we didn't like or maybe we hurt someone is harder than sort of shifting the blame. One example that comes to mind to illustrate what I mean by this sort of blame shifting is not too long ago, someone close to me found out that their partner was cheating on them. And when my friend confronted the person who cheated, they immediately became very defensive, refused to take any accountability, and basically found a way to explain the behavior, saying that it actually was because they didn't feel desired in the relationship. So in a way, the person who was cheated on was responsible for that person's behavior. And, you know, the thing with apologizing and admitting wrong is that it requires taking accountability for things that we may just generally feel really uncomfortable with. Like, hey, I may have said something, I may have done something that impacted someone else in a negative way. Okay, so let's kind of deconstruct and examine some of the factors that I feel are important when it comes to having a good apology or being able to admit that you were wrong. And by the way, these are just kind of field notes, things that I've observed, not necessarily the whole picture, because do I claim to be an expert on apology or admitting when I'm wrong? No. But in the times that I have or that I've been on the receiving end of an apology, these are the things that I've felt have worked really well. Number one is, I think, entering the conversation and dropping the personal defenses. If the intention of the conversation is to reinforce the idea in that person's mind that you actually are a good person and you just want to make sure that they know that, that in my head is not really an effective way to go about apologizing, because the focus is on maybe why you did that thing and not so much why it hurt the other person. I think when it comes to dropping personal defenses, this for me is about not transferring blame to something else, and also just not half apologizing or half-assing the apology, for lack of a better word. I'm sure that many of us have been on the receiving end of an apology that just doesn't feel genuine, and there are times in which I would have rather just not received an apology than receive like a half-baked apology that is meddled with a lot of self-defense and a lot of excuses. Another thing that I think is important, while it may be hard, is to drop any expectation of how the other person has to receive the apology. So, of course, the ideal scenario is that the other person will accept it or you'll be able to reconcile in some way, but it shouldn't be about that, and that shouldn't change your willingness to provide an apology. It should be done, in my opinion, with no strings attached and no expectation. Because again, if you've ever experienced this thing where someone apologizes and you don't immediately react in the way that they expect, and then they almost kind of get defensive again and almost sort of withdraw the apology, that to me isn't really a fair way to go about that conversation, because it puts pressure on the other person to have arrived at this place that maybe they're just not ready to be at yet. I think specificity is always valuable in apologies. So being explicit about what it is that you're apologizing for so that the other person has a clear understanding that you acknowledge that thing, versus being super vague about the reasoning. And then the last thing that I really like to both provide and receive when it comes to an apology, if the intention really is to resolve something and to reconnect with someone, is to have sort of a way forward, letting the person know, maybe, for example, what you do differently next time, or, you know, some sort of resolution, so that there's a clear commitment, maybe, that same pattern won't repeat itself. And if it does, here's the conversation that will be had. The next one that I want to discuss, and I've been thinking about a lot in terms of underrated life skills, is being able to healthily disagree with someone. And actually, when I put out the sticker on Instagram to get your guys' input, someone asked about this and kind of spoke to the fact that they were raised by sort of parents who argued a lot, and they never really saw an example of healthy conflict resolution. And they wanted me to speak to that, which works out well because this is one of the themes that I wanted to discuss either way. And before we get into it, I'll just say that I remember when I first, like in the first couple of years of living with a new partner, and that being a very new experience for me, I used to hear from like certain friends that them and their partner would never argue, which admittedly was very different from what I was experiencing. I feel like, especially in the first year of living together, we argued a decent amount. And when we would be having these arguments, they'd be very productive. We'd always come away feeling closer, and we'd always feel like we learned something about that other person, and it would always be pretty productive. And I didn't really see a problem with it until I started kind of comparing my situation to, again, a couple of friends who'd say that they never argued, which I'm not going to sit here and say, like, if you don't argue in your relationship, there's something wrong with you. I don't feel that way at all. But I think for many of us, we didn't ever have a healthy example of disagreement in a relationship and conflict resolution. So the idea of having any kind of conflict, whether that's in a relationship or a friendship, feels like there's something seriously, seriously wrong with the relationship potentially. Now, when it comes to having the ability to healthily disagree with someone, I'm sure we can all agree that there are exceptions to this, meaning that some conversations are simply not going to be productive, whether that's because there's a strong emotion on one side that isn't being regulated, or, you know, just the door is closed to seeing a different perspective on one or both sides. Whatever it may be, there are certainly circumstances in which the openness and willingness to access a different perspective other than our own is just not accessible in a conversation, and sometimes that's justified. I feel like even that is a skill of being able to discern which conversations are worth having and are worthy of our time and energy and which ones aren't. So, you know, part of that is asking, do I feel safe having this conversation? Is this going to lead to something productive? Am I prepared emotionally to have this disagreement? And, you know, the skill that I'm interested in exploring and honing myself is how to navigate these conversations when I'm willing to have them. And I don't always have to be willing to have them, and learning that is also okay. And, you know, personally, a lot of the examples I've witnessed and experienced over the years of disagreement have been more on the unhealthy side of the spectrum. Rarely have I seen examples of healthy disagreement that don't involve using a lot of force or aggression or, you know, belittling, personal attacks, or one or both parties shutting down. And seeing this play out so often in so many different spaces makes me realize that it seems to be that those skills to have those conversations are quite rare. And I think in order to begin to explore what some of these skills are a little further, I think the first question has to be, well, what is the point of having a conversation with someone on something that we disagree on? And in my mind, I think there are a few reasons. Number one, to open our minds and not live in an echo chamber.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Number two, to perhaps learn about an issue or a subject from different perspectives or lenses, which could potentially have the effect of shifting our perspective, but could also strengthen our perspective and reaffirm it because we've seen it through a different lens. I think these conversations can help us to examine and challenge our own internal biases and beliefs, which can help us to broaden our capacity to connect socially, meaning we're not limited to socializing and connecting with people who have the exact same life experience as us or the exact same views as us. And like overall, I think having the skill of being able to have these conversations can help us to both be understood by others better and understand others better and perhaps empathize further. And if you think about this on an interpersonal level, let's use the example of a relationship. If we're not willing to have certain conversations because we worry that there will be a disagreement, are we really allowing ourselves to be fully seen and to be fully known in that relationship? And again, I think knowing when to have these conversations and what topics are going to be productive versus what aren't going to be productive is important, but also being willing to have these conversations in a respectful way, I think from a relationship perspective, is a very powerful tool for connection. So I'm thinking about examples of this in my own life and how often these conversations are uncomfortable, but I find them to be expansive and challenging in a good way. So I haven't really talked much about this on the podcast, but I'm sure I've mentioned that religion is a big topic for me that in the past I've had a lot of trouble navigating. I was raised Catholic, and once I was old enough to make my own decisions, I definitely distanced myself from that whole world for a number of reasons. And so naturally, I gravitated to people who were also either no longer involved in religion or never were, or, you know, had similar views or experiences with religion. But of course, there continue to be people that I care about and interact with who have that strong connection with religion or those views. And it's challenged me to learn to have those conversations that I could otherwise avoid altogether. And in doing so, you know, learning to be open-minded and respectful to a completely different way of, you know, seeing the world, interacting with the world. And the reality is, I don't want my world to become so small that I'm only able to interact with and have mutually respectful conversations and relationships with people who agree with me on every single thing. And again, just to reiterate, when it comes to larger issues, of course, there are exceptions to this. But again, we arrive at the question of what are some of the things that can contribute to healthy disagreement. So one thing that I've noticed is that when someone's defense mechanism or sort of fight or flight is activated, it's really hard to have a conversation. And I think people's defense mechanisms get triggered when they feel attacked. And so part of this skill, from my perspective, is being able to create conversations in which there's a sense of safety and mutual respect. What I observe to have a negative impact on these types of conversations is when one person feels like they're being reprimanded by a parent or an authority figure, because I feel like we all naturally have a resistance or sort of recoil effect to that type of energy. And so managing the tone of the conversation, I think, is a real skill. And being able to, again, just maintain a tone of mutual respect. As an extension of that, as I said, I think it's important to keep conversations of this nature free of personal attacks. And, you know, I find tipping points in conversations like this interesting to observe. So the point at which things spiral out of control and they're no longer productive. And like I said, I think personal insults and attack have that impact on a conversation. Similarly, I think another tipping point is when one or both parties aren't effectively regulating emotionally. And that's just another thing that I think causes people's walls to go up. And it can be really, really hard to have a vulnerable, open-minded connection and conversation when one person feels attacked or feels at risk in some way. As I'm saying this, it's making me realize that conversations of this nature are almost like a mindfulness practice where you may feel the urge to let your emotions get the better of you, make personal attacks, but being able to regulate that for both people to be able to have a safe, productive, healthy conversation. And I don't think that that comes natural to many of us. And I don't think it's really taught to be able to do that. And a lot of the examples that we see, again, of conflict resolution or debates or people disagreeing are very charged, are very emotional, can become very toxic very quick. And so it's kind of difficult to know how to navigate that when we find ourselves in those situations. This kind of feeds into the next life skill that I want to discuss, which is a little bit more general and sort of applies to everything that we're talking about in this episode. But it's just the skill of self-control and self-regulation. Now, it's interesting because not too long ago, I recorded that episode on how I'm simplifying and decluttering my life. And one of the things I talked about was creating buffers to interrupt overconsumption. And when I recorded that episode, I felt like I was in a really good place, both from the perspective of digital and social media consumption, as well as just general shopping habits. So in other words, I was feeling like my level of self-control over this area of my life was pretty good. But as it happens, I started to feel myself getting sucked back into the cycle of both of those things, spending a lot more time on my phone and social media than I would have liked, and also just feeling this urge to shop and buy a lot more. And you know, what will often happen for me is it will be a cycle of interrupting that and realizing I'm in it and bringing myself back to a place of equilibrium. When I do find myself on the other side of that cycle and I have a little bit more clarity, I recognize just how all-consuming certain behaviors can be and how when I'm kind of in the thick of it, a lot of my self-control skills kind of go out the window. And much like the other two, I think I come by this honestly with the endless opportunities to consume and things constantly demanding our attention. And I also feel like that cycle can make us feel like there's something wrong when we're not participating in it. And for me, there's a lot of discomfort, for example, with being idle or not having something new to fixate on or spend money on. What I will say when it comes to self-regulation and self-control is that trying to be 100% perfect or, you know, very prescriptive with myself and creating rules for myself hasn't really worked super well for me in the past. I usually end up bouncing back to the other side of the pendulum, sort of like yo-yo dieting, where you restrict so much and then you binge because you've been deprived. My intention with the practice of self-control is usually more so managing the control that external things have over me and to not allow certain behaviors or impulses to run my life uninterrupted and to just be mindful of that balance and not perfect 100% of the time. And I know I'm not doing a good job of self-control when I'm consistently behaving out of alignment with my values or how I want to behave. A strong example of this for me was when I was in the cycle of being addicted to nicotine, which if you've ever experienced, you know it's really, really tough to manage. At least I found that to be the case. And when I was in that cycle, I really wasn't practicing self-control at all. And this substance was controlling my life in a way that I found to be concerning. Like, my actions weren't aligned with how I would want to behave. So, you know, vaping would be the first thing I did when I woke up, the last thing I did before bed. I'd feel really out of control and desperate if I didn't have access to a vape, if it ran out, if it was dead. I would sneak off to the bathroom at family gatherings to use it, and it just wasn't a good time, and it wasn't a good experience to have such an extreme example of something having control over me. And that's just a kind of lesson and a reminder to have the practices in place to interrupt that cycle. So again, that to me is a really important skill, is self-control. And I think because there are so many opportunities to consume, to become addicted to something, it really is something that is important in not allowing these things to be controlling our life instead of the other way around. One last thing that I wanted to discuss that I've really been strongly reminded of lately is patience. And I guess this also sort of ties into self-control, because it's being able to manage those feelings of wanting to be in control, wanting things to move faster, you know, frustration. And I think instant gratification and pretty much having everything at our fingertips has fed into this cycle of wanting everything to happen instantly and feeling very uncomfortable when we need to wait for something or we need to be patient. I'm actually recording this episode at almost 41 weeks pregnant, so I'll be a week past my due date tomorrow. And this has been such a theme for me in the last couple of weeks, is patience. And pregnancy is the first experience I've had in a while where I truly feel like I don't have much control over what's happening. And like right now, it's obviously just waiting for the baby to come. And the reality for me is I like to be doing something. I like to be active. I'd like to feel like I'm in control. So when I'm in this experience of just having to wait, I recognize and appreciate just how uncomfortable that is for me. I'm going to do a recap episode soon, but one of the things that I've noticed is all of the behaviors that emerge when I'm feeling impatient about something. And again, this comes down to not feeling in control. So I grasp at whatever I can to feel on some level like I'm regaining that. In my current circumstance, what that has looked like, this feeling of impatience and not being able to just kind of like let go, is for a period there, I was obsessed with doing all of the natural labor induction techniques, trying to move things forward, and like obsessively Googling any minor symptoms I was feeling, being like, does this mean I'm going into labor? And just any other behavior that made me feel like I was in control of the experience when in reality, I'm not. And truthfully, I don't want to interfere or rush the natural sequence of things, especially when it comes to having a baby. And also, like, as soon as it's here, it's here. And people always say when the baby does come, the moments fly by. So to be able to soak in every moment, I think, is very important. But I can become very ungrounded when I'm swept up in those behaviors of trying to feel like I have some sense of control, when really I just need to learn to be patient. I would say in the last week, I kind of gave up all my efforts to feel in control of this process. And honestly, it's been a lot more relaxing and enjoyable. And this is just one example of this overall desperate need that I have to always be getting to some sort of finish line or destination, to the point where I become so impatient and not present in the journey, in the process. And the thing that comes to mind here, which is very cliche, but I think it's true, is just that phrase of like, enjoy the journey. And I think really that's all life really is going from one point to the next. And so how can we expect that we're only going to be content when we arrive at those destinations? This is probably a whole separate conversation, but as I'm saying this, I'm wondering if part of it is rooted in capitalism, in that we always want something to show for what we're doing, some sort of tangible thing that we can hold up for ourselves and other people to see, that in the process of getting to that point and having that thing, we become so impatient and we want to rush our way through. So I also wanted to hear from you on some of the skills that you think are important but underrated. And a few people actually said being comfortable spending time alone, or, you know, being comfortable on your own, which I totally agree with, because I think having a foundation of comfortability within yourself and within your own presence, I think what I've noticed is that really extends into a lot of relationships, because you're not necessarily seeking to fill some void. You're looking to enhance the love that you already have for yourself. And also when the alternative of like spending time with people versus spending time alone isn't scary, meaning that like I'm not afraid to spend time alone, I feel like the people that we do seek out are going to be people that we actually want to be around, and we're not just kind of surrounding ourselves with people because we don't want to be alone. There were also a couple of responses about healthy conflict resolution, which we kind of touched on in this episode. And one person said learning that disagreement can be productive rather than destructive in a relationship. Some of the skills that you brought to light were actually a lot more practical, things like being on time and budgeting and money sense. One that I really liked was not focusing on other people's perceptions or opinions of you. And I would kind of add to this of having the ability to separate your opinion of yourself from the opinions that other people have of you. I feel like that is a really rare skill, because at least for me personally, in the past, I've allowed other people's opinions of me or potential projections or perceptions of me to have a great impact on my own self-image. And only now am I learning the importance of being able to decouple those two things and to recognize that those two things can be independent. People can feel a certain way about you based on their perception, their experience, and that doesn't have to paint the whole picture of who you are and basically inform how you live your life. Someone else said small talk. You meet so many people in professional settings, and this is such a skill. And then similarly, somebody else said being able to have a conversation with a stranger. And I actually agree with that. I think not only is that a skill, but it can make life easier in a lot of ways, in terms of like asking for directions or asking someone for ideas if you're traveling and asking for recommendations. It's such a thing that I think many of us are afraid to do, but I do agree can be so helpful in a lot of ways. And then one other person said keeping in contact with / reaching out to friends. And again, I do agree that that's an underrated skill, because it's something that in theory comes natural, but as you become more busy and other people have more commitments, being able to actually stay in touch with people, I do think is a real skill, especially when you think about living in different cities and, you know, being on different time zones, maybe. I think being able to put that effort in and to maintain those relationships is something that is really important to learn how to do, because maybe when we're younger, we're used to not having to really put in that effort. And what I'm realizing now in this phase of adulthood is it takes effort and it takes intention. And that I do believe is also a very important life skill. And with that, that brings us to the end of today's episode. I hope that you enjoyed this little reflection. And if you have any thoughts or additional ideas and things that I left out of those reflections, definitely feel free to share your input. But for now, I will leave this episode here. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.